From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump is calling former acting attorney general Sally Yates's testimony old news. Yates told senators yesterday that she warned the Trump administration that former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn had lied about his contact with the Russian ambassador. Flynn stayed in his job for 18 days after that warning. One of the moments from the hearing that's gotten a lot of attention was this one, in which Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz grilled Yates about President Trump's travel ban and what the law allows the president to do on immigration.
By the express text of the statute, it says, quote, "Whenever the president finds that the entry of any alien or of any class of aliens into the United States would be detrimental to the interests of the United States, he may, by proclamation and for such period as he shall deem necessary, suspend the entry of all aliens or any class of aliens as immigrants or non-immigrants, or impose on the entry of aliens any restrictions he may deem appropriate." Would you agree that that is broad statutory authorization?
I would, and I am familiar with that. And I'm also familiar with an additional provision of the INA that says no person shall receive preference or be discriminated against in issuance of a visa because of race, nationality, or place of birth. That, I believe, was promulgated after the statute that you just quoted. And that's been part of the discussion with the courts with respect to the INA, is whether this more specific statute trumps the first one that you just described.
Senator Richard Blumenthal, a Democrat from Connecticut, joins us now. Senator, welcome.
Thank you very much. Great to be with you.
And President Trump has said that everything Sally Yates said yesterday was old news. Did you learn anything new in yesterday's hearing that you didn't know before?
What we learned is that there remains a mystery, and a very alarming and astonishing mystery, about why the White House waited 2.5 weeks to fire Michael Flynn after learning that he was, in effect, a security risk because he was fatally compromised, vulnerable to blackmail because of his lies to the vice president and possibly to the FBI. His potential for indictment as a subject of criminal charges, extraordinarily troubling, and there's no adequate explanation. What we also saw was the need for a special prosecutor, because clearly only a special prosecutor can hold accountable Americans who colluded with Russian hacking and interference in our elections. And Donald Trump not only said last night that there was no new news, in effect fake news, but also he called the ongoing investigation a charade, which means that his appointees are also compromised. They cannot conduct an independent, impartial investigation.
But even Sally Yates wouldn't say that she thought there should be a special prosecutor.
Of course, she is now out of the department. Sally Yates has a lane. She sought to stay within it. I can well understand that, but there's overwhelming evidence of the need for a special prosecutor. And the intelligence committees can conduct investigations, but they cannot bring criminal charges. They cannot hold accountable and make people pay a price who have committed criminal acts.
Yates was testifying alongside the former director of national intelligence, James Clapper. And I want to listen to a clip here of California Democrat Dianne Feinstein asking Clapper and Yates about foreign intelligence about Trump team contacts with Russia.
Over the spring of 2016, multiple European allies passed on additional information to the United States about contacts between the Trump campaign and Russians. Is this accurate?
I can't answer that.
General Clapper, is that accurate?
Yes, it is, and it's also quite sensitive.
Senator, what do you draw from that answer?
What I draw from that answer is that there is intelligence about ties between the Trump campaign and the Russian attack on our election system. And, of course, they repeated many times that they could not answer certain questions because the material was classified, which I well understand. We're going to have another session where the setting will be secure and we can hear some of that classified information. But here was one of the most powerful moments of the hearing when Jim Clapper, who has seen a lot of subterfuge and sabotage and attacks on the United States, calling this Russian attack on our democracy one of the most serious he has seen. I'm paraphrasing, but his testimony about his alarm was extraordinarily powerful based on that intelligence that he mentioned, but also other information.
While we have you, I just want to get your thoughts on one other thing that's going on in the Senate, which is that we've learned that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is putting together a working group on health care reform, and it's all white men. Not that there's anything wrong with that. I'm a white man. You're a white man. But do you have a problem with that working group being formed in that way?
There's a reason that we have a democracy and elections, which is that our people will be truly and accurately represented. And that working group fails to represent America. It doesn't look like America, and question whether it will think like America.
What does that tell you, though, about what might come out of the Senate on health care? Is it going to be a bill that's very similar to the House bill, do you think?
If it is a bill similar to the House bill and Democrats have a part to play, it will go down. It will be dead on arrival on the floor of the Senate. And especially if the regular order is permitted to work and we have a 60-vote threshold, because there's a reason that Americans expect that health care will serve their needs. Health care ought to be regarded as a human right. And my fear is that this working group will fail to reflect America.
That's Senator Richard Blumenthal, a Democrat from Connecticut. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, President Trump was scheduled to meet today with his current National Security Advisor, Army General H.R. McMaster, as we've been hearing reports that U.S. commanders on the ground in Afghanistan have been asking for more U.S. troops to help the Afghan army fight a resurgent Taliban. The U.S. is also fighting ISIS in Afghanistan. Two U.S. Army Rangers were killed during a firefight with ISIS fighters earlier this month, although the Pentagon is investigating if they might have been killed by so-called friendly fire. Phil Ewing is NPR's National Security Editor. He joins us now. And Phil, right now there are about 9,000 American troops in Afghanistan. Do we know if there are talks to send more or how many?
There are talks to send more. This process began with a visit earlier this year by General John Nicholson, who's the top U.S. commander there. He told members of Congress the war in Afghanistan was, in his phrase, quote unquote, in stalemate, and that he needed many more forces to be able to break it open again. Many of those will probably come from the United States, and some of them will come from the European allies of NATO who have been alongside American troops there since the beginning of this conflict. Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis is in Europe this week to ask those allies to send more troops. And what we understand from defense and national security officials is under consideration here in Washington is simply doing more, sending more forces, pushing American advisors down to lower levels in the Afghan military, and picking up the pace of actual combat, especially in the counterterrorism fight. You mentioned a moment ago the threat of ISIS in Nangarhar. The U.S. could do more there. It could also do more to take out groups like the Haqqani Network that comes over the border from Pakistan and from these Taliban allies, especially in the south, who have made a lot of gains over the past few years because the Afghan military hasn't been able to hold the territory that it recaptured.
Well, you talk about pushing U.S. troops down to lower levels working with Afghans. Maybe, is that down to battalions? Are these going to be combat troops?
They probably will not be combat troops in the way they were in the previous phases of this war, although that appears to be possible, and Trump appears to be open to doing more of what the military calls kinetic operations, where American forces are in combat and fighting and killing hostile forces. It's also entirely possible that combat advisors could go down to the battalion level with Afghan leaders, and so instead of being embedded at the highest headquarters in the rear with the generals at the corps division levels, at the brigade or even battalion levels with operational forces who are actually outside the wire on patrol, and that the Americans believe enables them to give better advice and support to those forces, but it also exposes them to more of the dangers in combat.
Sure.
We saw an American sailor killed in Somalia this week who is doing that kind of mission with forces there against al-Shabaab.
Well, during the campaign, President Trump promised to be more aggressive fighting ISIS, but he said very little about Afghanistan, even though ISIS is there. What do we know is going on in his inner circle? What voices are being raised? Is this a debate within the White House, how many troops to send and how far down they go towards combat?
I don't know that it is that much of a debate. Trump has shown a willingness, which he's talked about publicly, to push decision-making on a lot of these issues down to the levels of his commanders. Lieutenant General McMaster, the National Security Advisor, Defense Secretary Mattis, General Nicholson in Afghanistan, Marine General Joe Dunford, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, they appear to have formed their own kind of working-level group and determined. Nicholson says he needs 3,000 more. Maybe we'll send 3,000 more, maybe less. And when they have finalized their recommendations and presented them to the president, it appears likely, at least now, that Trump will go along with what the commanders want. He sells it as a feature of his administration that he is no longer, as critics said Obama did, micromanaging these things from the White House. He says they have the room to run that he says they need to make these decisions about troop levels and strategy and the fight against ISIS in Afghanistan and all the other engagements that America is involved in.
So possibly thousands more U.S. troops in Afghanistan, the longest war in U.S. history, 16 years. Phil Ewing, NPR's national security editor, thank you.
Thank you.
Warning, we're about to have an adult conversation about a violent act. It will not be for all ears. We're going to talk to a rape survivor and the man who raped her. In 1996, Tom Stranger was an 18-year-old exchange student from Australia dating the then 16-year-old Thordis Elva in Iceland. Fast forward to 2016. They both electrified a TED Women Talk audience with their story. First of how, when they were teens, he brutally raped a drunken Thordis in her own bedroom for 2 hours.
My head had cleared up, but my body was still too weak to fight back, and the pain was blinding. I thought I'd be severed in two.
Then they also told of how years later they found some sort of reconciliation.
Saying to Thordis that I raped her changed my accord with myself as well as with her. But most importantly, the blame transferred from Thordis to me.
That began when 9 years after the rape, Thordis started an email exchange with Tom. Then the two met in Cape Town, South Africa, located between their two countries and the seat of restorative justice, to try to find some reconciliation of their own. Their TED Talk has since been viewed over 3 million times, and now they tell their story in their new book, South of Forgiveness, A True Story of Rape and Responsibility. Thordis, are you there?
I am.
Tom, you there as well?
Yes, I am.
Look, there are going to be, as you know, a number of people recoiling at the very notion of a rape survivor ever extending any kind of forgiveness to a perpetrator. So, Thordis, I want you to start there. What you're both talking about may not be forgiveness, may not be for everyone.
True. For me, I don't see forgiveness as you laying your blessing over the hurt that was caused to you. On the contrary, I see forgiveness as underlining the hurt that was caused to you. I needed to do it for myself, to shed some of the self-blame and shame that I'd wrongfully shouldered over the years.
Tom, any profits that come from the books that you've written you're going to be donating to charity?
Yes, that's correct.
And people might be wondering, how are they sitting here talking about this? Why isn't Tom in jail? We should also say that by the time you even realized what had happened, the statute of limitations had run out. Thordis, let's start there. 16, you were drinking at a dance. You didn't handle it well, as no 16-year-old will. Tom volunteered to take you home. You talk about how in your haze you thought, this is so gallant. We hear this all the time, that at this time you couldn't make sense of what was happening.
No, I couldn't. I was a 16-year-old kid with a head full of misconceptions about sexual violence, and I thought that perpetrators were unknown armed strangers that were lurking behind a bush and that would jump at you. It didn't make sense in my head that it could be your boyfriend and that it could happen in your own bed. And by the time that I dismantled these misconceptions, Tom had moved to the other side of the planet because his exchange program had been completed.
Yeah.
For the following 9 years, I tried my best to outrun this part of my past, tried to numb my emotions. I struggled with eating disorders. So it wasn't until 9 years later that I effectively broke my silence when one day a letter streamed out of my pen, much to my surprise, because I hadn't planned on writing it. But it was a detailed description of the events of that night, addressed to Tom with this unwavering wish to place the responsibility with him and find a way to enable myself to have a brighter future than the past that lay behind me.
Well, and to Thordis' surprise, Tom, you wrote her back.
I pushed away and basically drowned any reflections on that night. I had, I guess, an unconscious refusal to acknowledge and to own and to remember what I did. It wasn't until many years later that authorities sent me an email that very much jogged these memories, and it was irrefutable and undeniable, and I could recognize myself in what she was describing in this email. And to deny it and to not respond and to not write back would have caused further pain. So I did write back and essentially said, where to from here?
Well, and you end up going, as we said, to South Africa. And as a reader, your heart's pounding because you think, what's going to happen? I mean, is Tom going to be violent again? Is she going to take revenge on him?
Going to South Africa, you're right. The heart was pounding. I didn't know if this would result in a positive outcome, but I went there with tremendous hope that something constructive could be built out of a deep pain.
Yeah. Well, Tom, one of the things you both discovered was how much you had suffered. But, you know, people might be repelled to think of you as a victim and might have a hard time believing that you didn't really know for a long time what you did.
I can understand those reservations and not being able to relate to my act. And the last thing I'm seeking to do is to soften or to sanitize what I did. And it was a very long process to take that on, to own that, to understand it as something that I was once capable of. That is very much incongruous with who I know myself to be as well. So there was a lot of denial. There was a lot of suppression. There was a lot of
isolation in your life because, you know, deep down, you knew you'd done this. So it sounds like you were, on some level, punishing yourself.
Yeah, and that's the thing. In me having the privilege of speaking to this today, it almost feels like an abuse of that privilege if I make too much of my processes.
Yeah, yeah.
The week in Cape Town was very much about an analysis and a very long conversation to understand what the results were for Thortis, to understand what this had meant in her daily life, and to try and have some kind of comprehension of the damage that I caused. And I should state, not before that night and not since have I had any inclination to commit such an act of abuse, but it was, it's undeniable, but that I caused an immense amount of hurt. And in speaking about this publicly, I do hope that, you know, the audience for this might be young men who might harbour such damaging notions of entitlement to a woman's body that I did. And in speaking to Thortis, it's been important to kind of excavate and uncover the why and my motivations that night, and being able to understand face to face.
Thortis, I can hear Tom unwilling to talk about some of the ways this had impacted him because he's so conscious that he was the perpetrator. Were you surprised to hear how this had impacted him?
Yes, I was. I was surprised to realize that we had in some ways lived parallel lives. The shame and self-blame that I took on led me on a self-destructive path. And to some extent, that was mirrored by Tom. But the shame and blame that he took on were, of course, a natural result of his actions.
Right.
It was also very important to have that responsibility transferred from me to Tom, that I guess in a way liberated not just me, but also Tom from the running and the escapism that he had undergone for years and years.
Well, Tom, you know, the question for you was why? No one in your life is like this. You'd not seen violence. You'd not been brought up with this. And that's part of what you both figured, you know, or Thortis helped you figure out in South Africa, the why. What is the why?
It was a notion that almost a horrible expectation that if a boy goes out drinking with his girlfriend, he's entitled to sex. And of course it wasn't sex. There was no consent sought, nor did Thortis give me any consent. And that with a mix of a self-absorbed self-centeredness and damaging ideas.
A part of the problem when it comes to sexual violence, it has been the silence of those who commit it. The silence has not just been with the survivors, but also with the perpetrators. Their invisibility and how unaccountable they've been.
Hey, Tom, and what would you say to men who might say, date rape, it's different from rape?
I've been really privileged to have some amazing conversations with men. One of the most affecting one for me was with a group in Sweden called Fahtaman. There was one particular initiative and a slogan. It begins with me. talks that notion that this is deeply culturally rooted. But you're absolutely right. I've also been speaking to men, have been offered excuses, been told, you know, you're only 18, we're all hormonal, you were drinking, which very much tells me that there's still a long way to go.
Do you think that you're unique in being able to do this? You were, you know, friends before. What do you say to women who say, I could never risk approaching my perpetrator?
To anyone who's been subjected to any kind of abuse, my main advice is always put your safety first. I contacted Tom from the other side of the planet through a written medium. And yes, you're right. The unique circumstances under which our story took place, of course, is the sole reason why we're even able to sit here today.
Well, you're both married to other people and still on this journey together. We've heard of how something lifted for Thordis, Tom, and you claiming responsibility. Did something lift for you as well?
Yeah, I've come to a place of understanding. That certainly doesn't sever any ties to that night, nor my responsibility for it. It's something that's always obviously difficult to ever be at peace with, but I am blessed in that, yes, I'm in a supporting and loving marriage and have the support and understanding of some of my friends and family. So, and are just infused with a purpose to hopefully transmute this into something beneficial.
That's Tom Stranger and also Thordis Elva. Tom, Thordis, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thanks.
Bye. Bye-bye. Thordis and Tom's book is South of Forgiveness, True Story of Rape and Responsibility. Their companion book, The Little Book of Restorative Justice for Sexual Abuse, has information that might guide others. We'll have links to their TED Talk, resources for rape survivors and for perpetrators, men who've raped, who want to make this a men's issue as well, at hereandnow.org.
The Blues Music Awards take place on Thursday in Memphis, one of the homes of the blues, but 8 nominations are directly linked to a hefty, chain-smoking Norwegian from San Jose, California. Rachel Miro of Here and Now contributor KQED has the story.
Christopher Anderson, or Kid Anderson, first made his name on the Bay Area blues scene as a guitar player. This is him on Never Trust a Woman with Rick Estrin and the Nightcats. Anderson fell in love with blues music when he was growing up in Norway, all the way across the Atlantic.
When I first heard blues, it sounded mysterious and it sounded dark and it sounded magical and you didn't really know what was going on, you know, it was murky.
When he was 21, a San Francisco Bay Area band leader asked him out here, and Anderson didn't hesitate. He loved West Coast blues. He played for a handful of bands and recorded a number of albums before he realized he could and should produce albums, too.
It was just frustrating for me to work with engineers and studio owners who didn't have a relationship, a love for the kind of music I did.
Today, at 37, he operates out of a sun-baked house in San Jose he's dubbed Greaseland Studios. You know, like Elvis Presley's Graceland, but way less fancy and crammed from the front door to the back with musical instruments, most of which he can play himself.
Oh, I got a drum kit set up. There's about 50 guitars around here.
There's a grand piano in the kitchen, along with a harpsichord and a sitar.
Right behind you there is the laundry room, which is also the vocal booth.
With all the gear, the ability to play it, and a blues musician's sensibility, Anderson quickly developed a reputation in the blues world. He's lost count, but he figures he's produced something like 100 albums, including My Blue Soul. Over here is where I work, I ain't gonna live. The album that got Terry O'Dabi of Oakland nominated for Best Female Soul Blues Artist this year and Best Emerging Artist. Here's Anderson playing on Adavi's song, Gentrification Blues. Adavi acknowledges it's a little odd that a big white guy with a mop of corn-yellow blonde hair is so devoted to a music genre rooted in the Black American experience. But she says she respects where he's coming from and what he can do.
Regardless of whether he's from Norway or he's from white or whatever, kid throws down. He's amazing.
Aki Kumar, the Indian-born Silicon Valley harmonica phenom, has co-produced all three of his albums with Anderson.
You know, he's a big presence, just physically and musically. Somebody who can play, back you up, give you musical advice and guidance on arrangements and how to get the whole song together, and also record all of it in an excellent way and mix it down and put it together for you. It's like a one-stop shop for awesomeness.
Anderson's also nominated for Best Instrumentalist Guitar this year. Somehow it's been years since he produced an album of his own music. But one way or another, he's making music that sings to a wide audience, helping to keep the blues flame lit. For Here and Now, I'm Rachel Miro in San Jose.
For the next few minutes, we're going to look into that lawsuit launched by the Southern Poverty Law Center against Andrew Anglin, founder of the neo-Nazi website The Daily Stormer, and a warning, the language will be offensive to many. The suit alleges that Anglin launched a troll storm against Montana real estate agent Tanya Gersh and her family because of an interaction between Gersh and Sherry Spencer. Sherry Spencer is the mother of Richard Spencer, who came to national attention when he held that neo-Nazi rally in Washington right after the election. His mother owns a building in Whitefish he often visits. Some residents are in an uproar. Tanya Gersh, the lawsuit plaintiff, was quoted by a local TV station saying Sherry Spencer facilitated her son's work by letting him use her home address for his group. And then later, Tanya Gersh said that the mother could address the upset in Whitefish by selling the building, donating some of the proceeds to a human rights organization, and addressing some of her son's white supremacist ideas. Well, Sherry Spencer, the mother, called that extortion, and Anglin told his followers to take action against the Jews targeting Richard Spencer's mother. We're going to be joined by Richard Cohen, president of the Southern Poverty Law Center, but first, Tanya Gersh. Tanya, in your view, what happened?
You know, after Richard Spencer's Nazi salute at his conference in Washington, D.C., it went viral in Whitefish, and everyone was really concerned. So I reached out to the business owners in her building because they're my friends. And then Richard's mom, Sherry, ended up calling me to talk about what she should do about the building. And she asked me to help her sell the building. She asked me to help her make a public statement about the building. And I said yes. And then a few weeks later, she posted the blog that I was extorting her. And then the very next day, Andrew Anglin started posting article after article after article about me, calling on all his followers to harass me and my family.
Look, in case someone thinks that this is just giving you the raspberry on the street, some of the messages that you and your family got are abhorrent. He also gave out your phone number and address, by the way, but can you just read some of the comments? Do you mind? I have them in front of me if you don't want to do it.
You know, a lot of them were, you know, we're going to drive you to the brink of suicide. This is the way that we can keep the Holocaust alive forever. We can bury you without touching you, you dirty, ugly, kike Jew. Mm-hmm. It was just the worst anti-Semitic stuff that you could possibly imagine.
Well, here's some more. Thanks for demonstrating why your race needs to be collectively ovened. 6 million are only the beginning. We're going to keep track of you the rest of your life. Here's one email to your husband. Put your uppity slut wife, Tanya, back in her cage, you rat-faced kike. Day of the rope soon for your entire family. What was happening to you when this was, I mean, this isn't just one or two. This is 700 at, you know, one point. What's happening to you?
You know, I'm in therapy and I'm, you know, we're rebuilding our lives. We're trying to go back to life as normal. But, you know, one of the things that was most concerning about this was my son. They attacked my 12-year-old son in any way they could reach him. They photoshopped endless images of him on and put him on the gates to Auschwitz concentration camp. And, you know, so, like, how do you explain this to your children? And what we're doing is just trying to go on with our lives the best we can.
Yeah. Well, let's bring in Richard Cohen, again, of the Southern Poverty Law Center, suing Andrew Anglin. Richard, lots of websites encourage readers to mobilize. Tanya had made public comments. Can't Anglin claim that his is free speech?
Not at all. This is the intentional infliction of emotional distress, as if it's ever happened.
Here you have Andrew Anglin. He refers to his followers as his family and says, light them up, go after her. It's basically make her life miserable, harass her. No one has the right to launch a vicious anti-Semitic troll storm against someone else. Sure, you know, you have the right in this country to hate people, but you don't have the right to hurt them. And Anglin and his followers certainly crossed the line. And Anglin intended them to do it. You know, he had this one time a disclaimer, oh, don't do anything illegal or something like that. And that disclaimer wasn't intended to protect Tanya from harassment. It was intended to protect Anglin from accountability.
Well, let's remind ourselves who Andrew Anglin is. His is said to be the most virulent. It's the leading extremist website. It's the Daily Stürmer, which is named after a Nazi propaganda sheet, Der Stürmer. After the election of Donald Trump, he claimed credit. Our glorious leader has ascended to God Emperor. Make no mistake about it. We did this. If it were not for us, it wouldn't have been possible. And after the election, he encouraged his followers to harass Muslims and any foreigners you see.
Right. He said to make them afraid. That was something that was generalized towards, you know, kind of all Muslims that his followers might see. In Tanya's case, it was directed at her and her family much more intensely. Starting, quite frankly, coinciding with Mr. Trump's campaign, his website became the most heavily traveled neo-Nazi website out there, eclipsing Stormfront, which was formerly, you know, maybe the oldest neo-Nazi website out there. And so really quite a few, and Tanya heard from a lot of them.
Tanya, why are, I mean, we're appreciative that you're talking so that people can be aware of this.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, I'd think you'd want to maybe, you know, go undercover, move, hide.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, he did encourage people to visit me in person. He encouraged them to call me up and come visit me. This was beyond harassment. This wasn't teasing. It was terrorism. And there's people, whether they're different colors or nationalities or gay or Jewish, that this is happening to. And it's simply not okay. I couldn't live with myself if I didn't stand up. I want to be the last one that Andrew Anglin attacks.
Are you able to still run a real estate business?
So, you know what? I'm trying to go on with my life as much as I can, but there's serious safety concerns for me. I had to give away my listings because I didn't want to put my clients' properties at risk. And I certainly am not answering phones randomly and to meet people that I don't know. But I'm trying, you know, I'm trying to live my life. Is it what it once was? Absolutely not.
Richard Cohen, I want to bring you back in. In the Southern Poverty Law Center release, you say that it's been proven that people like Dylann Roof, who massacred the 9 African-Americans in the Charleston church, posted on the site, that James Jackson, who traveled to New York City, we remember that story, his plan was to kill a black man, and he did. Well, at least he's charged with murder. Are you planning on entering in court that Andrew Anglin can lead to violence?
Well, I'm not sure that those particular things will be admissible. I think it's important for the public to understand just how dangerous the game Andrew Anglin is playing is. Another person, the person who killed the British member of parliament recently, was also someone who was a subscriber to the Daily Stürmer.
So what are you saying? What law was broken?
Well, we have 3 causes of action. I think the one that's maybe clearest to understand is the intentional infliction of emotional distress. Also under Montana law, it's illegal to intrude onto someone's solitude. It's an invasion of privacy. And lastly, Montana has an anti-intimidation statute that was designed exactly for cases like this. And what we hope to do is get a large damage award against Andrew Anglin, an award that will compensate Tanya for the harm she's suffered, and just as importantly, an award that will punish Andrew Anglin for what he's done and send a message to other people like him who would launch a troll storm and would use the net to orchestrate a campaign of harassment.
Do you worry that you'll elevate him?
Well, look, he's already a big star in the world of white supremacy. And what I hope our case does is knock him down a notch and expose him for what he is, someone who is an internet bully, as Tanya said, an internet terrorist.
That's Richard Cohen, president of the Southern Poverty Law Center, representing Tanya Gersh in a lawsuit the SPLC has brought against white supremacist Andrew Anglin. Richard, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
And Tanya, please be safe.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And we reached out to Andrew Anglin of the Daily Stormer for comment, but have not heard back.
Can one late-night host change U.S. policy? I'm not talking about Jimmy Kimmel and healthcare. I'm talking about John Oliver. On Sunday, HBO's Last Week Tonight aired a 20-minute segment in which Oliver defended net neutrality, the internet rules that prevent internet service providers from favoring particular content. Last month, FCC Chairman Ajit Pai proposed the first steps to undoing those rules. So Oliver urged his viewers to reject Pai's proposal by going to the FCC's website, searching for the proposal, filling in a form, and leaving a comment.
And if you're thinking, well, look, that's just too complicated, I'm not doing it, don't worry, because that's why we bought the URL gofccyourself.com. And if you simply go there, it will land you straight on this page, where all you have to do is hit express and comment telling Ajit Pai that you specifically support strong net neutrality backed by Title II oversight of ISPs.
Well, after he directed traffic to the FCC's website, it crashed. Here to explain is our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Tony Rahm is senior editor of policy and politics for Recode. He joins us from New York. Hi, Tony.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. And before we go any further, let me ask you to do what we have to do every time we do a story about net neutrality, which is to explain what it is. 30 seconds, go.
Net neutrality is the idea that internet service providers like an AT&T or a Comcast or a Verizon have to treat all web traffic equally. So they can't slow down web pages or competing services they don't like, and they can't block them either.
And the Trump administration wants to change the net neutrality rules.
Yeah, the Trump administration is no fan of the rules put in place during President Barack Obama's term. You know, Chairman Tom Wheeler at the time wanted to treat internet providers in the same way that the FCC currently treats old school telephone companies. But Republicans then and now believe that's heavy-handed regulation and they want to start undoing it.
So when Oliver's segment first aired, the news was that the increased traffic might have caused the FCC's site to crash. But now the FCC is denying that. What do we know?
Yeah, well, we know that there was an influx of traffic. John Oliver ran his segment on Sunday night, and by the end of Monday, more than 150,000 comments had poured into the FCC. There had been 30,000 comments before that period of time. So regardless, there was an uptick in activity at the agency as folks wrote into the FCC to declare their thoughts on net neutrality. Now, whether that's Oliver or not, you know, no one can really say. And whether he took down the agency's webpage or not potentially doesn't even matter. You know, the agency says it was a cyber attack. But regardless, folks are going to continue to weigh into the FCC. Net neutrality is a very emotional debate for many internet users. And, you know, regardless as to what happened just a few days ago, folks will continue to weigh in.
And this is not the first time that something like this has happened either, right? Even with John Oliver.
Yeah, you could be forgiven for feeling a bit of deja vu right now. Chairman Tom Wheeler faced some of the same blowback when he sought to fix the FCC's net neutrality rules. At the time, a court had handed the FCC a major defeat and forced the administration back to the drawing board. And when Tom Wheeler was considering a different proposal for net neutrality, John Oliver issued a similar call to action, and thousands of folks wrote the agency. By the time the FCC had put forward its rules, about 4 million comments had flooded the FCC. It was a bit of a record for them, for this wonky telecom agency in Washington. And so Pai, as he looks to undo that work, is expecting to have the same sort of reaction from internet users going forward.
So what happens to net neutrality rules next?
That's the big question. You know, I spoke with Chairman Pai just a few days ago to get his thoughts as to what happens from here. And the takeaway from the agency is that while they do believe that there should, that, you know, internet providers should not slow down or block web content, they don't believe in the rules that Chairman Wheeler and Democrats put into place. What they ultimately choose to adopt or whether they scrap all net neutrality rules whatsoever is a process that will unfold over the coming months. But Pai, for right now, insists that the Obama administration Trump's approach doesn't work, and something has to change.
That's Tony Rahm, senior editor of Policy and Politics for Recode. Tony, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And now let's take a minute to talk about Jimmy Kimmel. Last week, Kimmel made an unusual plea for universal access to health care, in which he spoke about his son, who was born with severe heart defects. Last night, Kimmel addressed the issue again and the Republican effort to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act.
1 week ago tonight, I made an emotional speech that was seen by millions. And as a result of my powerful words on that night, Republicans in Congress had second thoughts about repeal and replace. They realized that what is right is right. And I saved health insurance in the United States of America. Thank you. I didn't save it. They voted against it anyway.
Well, Kimmel's initial plea was heavily criticized for being too political. So in his monologue last night, he addressed his critics on that.
And I would like to apologize for saying that children in America should have health care. It was insensitive. It was offensive, and I hope you can find it in your heart to forgive me.
Something tells me we haven't heard the last of this. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. Move over, Jimmy Fallon. It is Here and Now.